Welcome and thanks for listening to Relational Practice, a Social Work Podcast. I'm Jodie.
Jodie Park. Dr. Jodie Park.
That's right, Jodie Park.
And I'm Rose Mackey. And we are both private practice social workers who work in the child protection and trauma fields. And today, as always, we're recording on Darawal Land, New South Wales, Australia. Please like and subscribe to our podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram and send us any questions or comments you have.
We would really like to hear from you. So our email is relationalpractice01, all lowercase, at gmail.com. I'll make sure that we put that I put the email in the little notes section of wherever you're finding this podcast so that you can access it there. But we really want you to tell us about your practice. We really want you to tell us about your stories. We want you to tell us stories that you're proud of. We want you to tell us practice stories which has generated a lot of reflection and learning for you. And we want you to tell us your funny stories. Honestly, we just want to hear from you. So we want you to tell us anything that's related to practice that we can read out and share on our podcast. Because part of this podcast is, a large part of this podcast, to be honest, is about building a community, building some engagement. It's not just about you sitting there listening to Rose and I, because I mean, we're actually pretty boring people, really. Yeah. It's going to be so much more...
Interactive,
yeah. I mean, I was going to say it's going to be so much more better, but then I realised you can't actually say that. So anyway.
Beneficial. The listeners may get a little bit more out of it if there's more interaction.
Well, yeah. And it's just going to be like, overall, it's going to be much more entertaining.
True.
And useful to hear from other people as well as us. Yeah. So that's the point. Yep. It's about building that community. I was going to say community impact practice, but I think that's...
Please don't.
I know you give me that base because it's such a...
A wink.
It is. I was going to say that too, but I sounded against it, but you're right. Such a wanky wink. But anyway, I shouldn't have said that. All right. Anyway, send us stuff. That's our Gmail, relationalpractice01@gmail.com. All right.
Well, I think before we jump into the episode, you just would like to give a shout out to Hannah Park. The music at the beginning of the podcast and the end is by a beautiful artist named Hannah Park. And if you're putting the dots together, yes, that's Jodie's daughter. She's an exceptional musician. And check out her music. It is on Spotify.
It is on Spotify. So if you put her name in, you will find it. The song is that you're listening to is called The Tide.
And it actually really ties in nicely, we think.
It's so good. Yeah.
Yeah. So shout out to Hannah Park and also to Angus, our podcasting editor.
Yeah. Angus does a great job fixing the mess that we create when we try and record this. So thank you so much, Angus.
I think I'm not sure, Angus, if you're sitting there rolling your eyes as you're listening to this, but we do make a mess and you make our work seem so polished and professional. So Angus Pinkstone, we appreciate all of your editing skills.
I know. Thank you so much. All right, let's get on to it.
Alrighty. So what are we talking about this episode? We are talking about power in practice. So that's a massive topic.
Yeah, it is.
And the way we talk about it today would probably be different in how we talk about it tomorrow and how we talked about it yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's not an all-encompassing full stop power in practice episode because that would be impossible. But we will be talking about power in this episode from our personal position, linking it to our own practice experience and expertise, and hopefully generating lots of thoughts and lots of discussion about power in practice. But as we said earlier, disclaimer, it is not the entirety of power in social work practice because that would be impossible in a 45-minute podcast.
Well, because there's a general lack of consensus, really, amongst the social work world, wider than just the social work world, I think amongst any profession that works directly with people as to what power actually relates to.
Mm.
So
I think it's a concept that also changes for me as I grow and develop professionally too. So the way I thought about power 5 years ago is very different to today as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. And I guess when I think about the role of power in practice is that I always think that as a social worker, what I try to do is empower individuals, groups, families, and communities by promoting their own existing strengths. And it's about identifying, helping them to identify and then, I guess, harness their internal capacity. Whilst at the same time advocating for supports to address inequality and internal and external deficits. That's kind of what I think about when I think about power. That's the role of social work, but that's also the role of people that work with, I guess, anybody in that kind of that profession.
Yeah. So when you say that, Jodie, I think of two, I guess, theoretical perspectives, and one is a strengths-based perspective in social work.
Yeah.
And you put it very eloquently.
Yeah.
And then probably any oppressive practice,
yeah,
which we will hopefully weave in and out of this episode, because I think you talked about working with the individuals and then working with the systems. And I guess the way I understand and think about any oppressive practice is more from a systems perspective than an individual
mm-hmm.
perspective.
Yeah.
And so it'd be really good to see if I still think the same at the end of our conversation.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to be giving the practice example today. And so I will start, it's a very long one, so I will start with that in a minute. But I just wanted to say one thing about strength-focused work, because I think that, you know, when I think about strength-focused work, I know I'm not, what should I call that? What did you say? Strength-focused?
Just strength, what you're saying?
I thought I was saying it. Incorrectly. No. I think as with everything, the interpretation of what is actually a strength focused practice is really up to the agency, the system, the individual, in terms of how they exact that. Because I think sometimes what happens, and this is actually tying to my practice example, is that in trying to be solely strength focused, people forget that it's also okay to identify needs, and it's also okay to identify things that might be deficits.
Yes. And sometimes, would you agree, we are so strengths focused that we're actually embellishing a strength.
Oh, yeah.
And blending into something different, because it may feel better, it may sit better positionally with the agency you're working with, and it's not necessarily a proper strengths-based approach.
Yeah, well, I guess if you think back to where strength-focused practice came from the work of brief solution-focused therapy. And in that therapy, part of that therapy is about helping the person that you are working with identify strengths. And those strengths can be, you know, anything. And it can, like, small or big, I guess, because it's about what action that person identifies as a strength for them. Yeah?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you kind of just leave it there, because what brief solution focused therapy is, it's about you identify the strength. And please don't come at me if you're like an expert in this. This is my understanding of brief solution focused therapy. Ah, dear. But, you know, from my understanding, you identify a strength, but then you look at how can you, I guess, build upon that strength to address the need that actually is undermining or negatively influencing the person's current functioning.
I would agree, that's my interpretation too. It's almost why motivational interviewing sits very nice in that framework, because you're looking at, there's a strength here. How do we build upon that to address this current presenting concern?
Yeah.
Or is there something about the capacity that is different to when you actually were able to achieve whatever this was back here? So what's changed, what's different, and then how do you work at addressing those challenges?
That's the thing. I guess that's the thing. That's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah.
The point is, okay, this is a strength. This is a strength that I've identified. This is how it influences your current life. But this is how the challenges that you're experiencing also influence your current life. How can we use this strength to increase the times where you may feel in control of your own life, your own thought patterns, your own emotions, therefore reducing the times where you feel out of control, when the challenges are in control.
Yeah.
And it fits really nicely, I think, with kind of, you know, with narrative approaches, which is where you kind of, you know, you put the problem in a box and you put the box over here and you explore exceptions to the time when the problem was the problem, because then you're using strength work to explore those exceptions.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It does. In a nutshell.
I'm so glad I'm making sense, because in my own mind, I'm like, what are you saying? But yeah, whereas, you know, I guess I started this conversation by saying that I think sometimes that the rest of that gets, like, the rest of that exploration of strengths and challenges gets missed, and it's all very much about, well, let's at all cost identify a strength. And therefore, this family has lots of strengths.
And then you think about, we're talking about power.
Yeah, yeah.
How that ties in as that individual one-on-one power.
Yeah.
Nice for that client or the family you're working with to have identified their strengths, but is that actually assisting them to look at the current challenges that have brought a social work into their life?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how is it addressing those challenges if all we're ever doing is looking at their strengths?
Yeah, it's not. It's actually not. And I guess it kind of really ties nicely in with my practice example, because that's what I talk about. I talk about how the interpretation of the interpretation of professionalism I was relying upon in my family work at the time actually just led to me disempowering the client, but also disempowering myself.
Well, I can't wait to hear the example. Do you want to jump into it, or did you want to talk any more about, I guess, setting up the conversation?
I think I'm okay with jumping in, because I think I just want to say, and I think we've already said it probably, is that, you know, power is tricky. Understanding the role of power is tricky. And if it's tricky for us as professionals with some education and some experience under our belts, imagine how tricky it is for the people that we work with to also get their heads around this whole notion of power and what that means. All right, let me jump into my example. Okay, so I am going to give a practice example that really, for me, I think best illustrates when I wasn't clear, as I said before, when I wasn't clear around the role of power in my practice. And for me, not being clear around the role of practice also kind of coexisted with some role confusion that I had at the time as well. So I was kind of practicing from this position of not really being clear around who was my client, what my role was, what I was meant to be doing at some stages in my practice, and then just really not understanding or acknowledging the power associated with my role. So it is something that happened to me very, very early in my career. Not in my first job, but certainly I think it was probably in my second position. So around 2001, 2002, somewhere around then. So a long time ago. And I was working as a family support worker, and it was in a specialized family support program. I won't name the program. I won't name the agency, because I just didn't know whether to or not. So I decided just to err on the side of caution, because I don't want there to be any identifying information that could breach confidentiality. The program worked with families where parental drug and alcohol use was present. And, it was kind of when parental drug and alcohol use was assessed as a risk issue for children or an unborn child.
Okay.
The program was really new. And so we had a small team. There was me and three other family support workers, and we had the most amazing kind of kick-ass manager who really drove funding for the program, was really influential in and instrumental in getting the program happening. So there was a lot invested in this program at the time, and that was the practice context that's really important to understand, that it was a new program. There really weren't a lot of procedures, policies written, because we were writing them as we were going. The program was being evaluated by university at the same time.
Lots of eyes on.
There was lots of eyes on, and there was a focus on outcomes. Outcomes for the program, which were a reduction in the numbers of children being removed.
Okay.
and improved outcomes for the children in the families we worked with in terms of a reduction in drug and alcohol use.
So is that reduction in children in care and drug use, like, are we talking in a short time frame or like over a long period of time where the outcomes been evaluated?
Do you know what? I actually can't remember. I definitely think it was, the removal was around birth.
Yeah.
Because we worked with a lot of pregnant women. So it was a reduction in the amount of removals at birth. Yes. And I think it was around the drug and alcohol use. I think it was around the time that we were involved, and we could be involved for up to 3 years.
Okay. But they wanted some pretty immediate data on results.
Absolutely.
If we think about cycle of change and
yeah.
intergenerational trauma and all of those, you know, concerns and challenges that when you think about parental drug use, there's a lot to work through in what seems like such a short time, Jodie.
There was
to get some results.
Absolutely. And the families had some commonalities. So, you know, and of course there were outlying families that didn't have all of these,
yeah.
all of these risk factors, but most of the families had, you know, mental health issues, you know, that coexisted with drug use, that coexisted with family violence or domestic violence. You know, yeah, it was also usually a history of childhood trauma. So that was a lot.
And I would assume some housing issues, social issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And because we were this new team, because we were kind of just working the practice out as we went, it was a very supportive, cohesive team. Very strong manager, but we basically worked on our own. It's not like we went out in pairs. It's not like we were even in the office a lot of the times. We basically worked out of our cars.
So you're like pretty much very autonomous in your day to day.
Yeah, very much.
So your practice as compared to another colleague's practice could have been very similar, could have been completely different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And there would be weeks where we would not cross over. There would be definitely weeks where that didn't happen, where we may have seen each other in passing. I'm talking about as a team, as a collective, but, you know, we may not have also. Our manager was always very, very available, but you had to know to reach out as well.
So more informal supervision.
Definitely formal supervision as well, but it was that stuff around, you had to know what was a problem to identify a problem.
That's really tricky when you think about biases and blind spots as a practitioner.
Yes, and you think about the practice context and the pressure.
Yeah.
And you think about, and this is where we're going to lead into role confusion, the family support role. Family support is a hard gig.
It's so hard.
It's hard because you have to be everything to everybody.
So explain that a little more.
So what that means is that, you know, our client was the child, but you can't actually, you know, do a lot of work with an unborn. So you're doing your work with the parent. So therefore the parent becomes your client informally because that's the person you're working with. Yep. And if there's two parents, you're working with both parents. If there's one parent, you're working with one parent. So already you've got some divided loyalties there in terms of who is your client and whose needs are going to prioritise.
And what if there's other children in the home?
Absolutely.
Because they'd become pseudo clients too.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we've got some divided loyalties there already, some divided understanding about whose needs need to be paramount.
Yep.
Because you're actually doing all your work with the parent, with the adult. Yeah. And then you've got this family support role where, like I said before, you have to be all things to everybody. So, you know, any given day you could be sitting in a formal meeting and advocating strongly for your client in terms of what their needs are and what their challenges are and what supports they need. You could be helping them to clean their house because that's been an identified need. Or you could be, you know, trying to pack them up and find housing and actually moving them, actually doing the physical moving. Or you could be find yourself in this kind of informal therapy role where you're actually, you know, having these conversations that are about big things, big, big things. And you're finding, what's that term called? I can't remember what that term's called. Accidental counselor. You find yourself in this kind of counseling role where you're not a counselor. That's not your role.
It's not your role.
So it's a really hard role to understand, which is why, and I didn't know this at the time, but with reflection, I realized how confused I was about the role. But underpinning all of that role confusion is this confused understanding about the role of professional power, because the family support role, in my experience at that time, there was this emphasis on working alongside this family in the good and the bad, doing whatever you needed to do.
Because the end goal was children are not removed at birth. And
that's right.
There's a reduction in parental substance use.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the overarching goal and aim, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you're working towards that at all costs.
At all costs. And there was no conversations about power, professional power, about the power in the relationship, what that looks like, about empowering clients versus disempowering clients. There was no conversations like that. It's not like we knew that stuff back then.
Yeah, okay.
It, of course, was there. Of course. Power's not a new thing, but it's not like it was talked about.
So as you're, I don't know, maybe scrubbing the dishes, packing clothes into a bag to help a family move.
As you're building rapport, as you're trying to do whatever you have to do to get that family on side, you're negating your professional power, because what you're doing is pretending it doesn't exist.
Because you're side by side.
Because you're side by side. And you become a little bit like a friend. There's some real boundary issues with the family support role. In my experience, I'm talking about, because you can become a bit like a friend. Which, as well, I'll talk about the example, but that's huge. If the client sees you as a friend and not as a professional, or there's this blurring of boundaries around the two, you know, it impacts so greatly on, I guess their ability to trust professionals in the future, because they've had this experience.
And depending on the outcome.
Yeah.
It could be either social workers are amazing and great and they were very helpful, or I trusted this person and she did all this work with me, and then the end result was disastrous.
Yeah, which is what happened in this situation. All right, so I'm going to talk about this family. So there was a mother, there was a father, a young couple, and they had a baby. I became involved with them when she was pregnant. So I probably had been involved with this family for about 18 months at this stage, because she was referred very early pregnancy. And I think baby was probably about 6 months. No, must have been odd, about 9 months old at the time. So very aware of surroundings. I mean, babies are always very aware of surroundings, but really needed to have that kind of parenting that was safe and predictable and consistent and reliable.
Mm-hmm.
The family, mum had drug and alcohol, long history of drug and alcohol issues involving heroin. Her drug of choice was heroin. Dad had a long history of drug and alcohol issues. His drug of choice was crystal meth. And at the time, back in 2001, 2002, crystal meth wasn't that big. Like, it was really funny, because most of the clients I worked with, heroin and cannabis was their drug of use, and they looked down at crystal meth users. There was like a hierarchy.
Yeah.
And people that use crystal meth were honestly considered the lowest of the low and really unpredictable and dangerous.
I remember those times.
You remember those? Yeah.
I was in medicated detox working.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, in early 2000. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It would be rare to have someone come in.
Yeah. So this dad, crystal meth was his drug of choice, and he was very unpredictable. His mood was very unpredictable. His behaviors were very unpredictable. There was a lot of violence in the relationship that was hidden for a long time. Of course, I knew it was there, but it wasn't something they talked about. And I worked a lot with the mum, you know, both of them, but probably more with the mum, because the dad became a bit of an absent dad. And I think there was a period of time after the baby's birth where his drug use became really problematic, and it was really unsafe for her. And so it took me a long time to get her to acknowledge that it was unsafe, because this was a relationship for her. She came from her own history of being in out-of-home care. She had no family relationships. She wanted this relationship with this man to be sustained at all costs.
Mm.
So we tried a couple of times to get her out of the home safely.
With the child?
With the child, yeah. And she constantly, she you know, it was scary. And so she constantly kind of backed out. So there was this one day, his drug use was becoming more erratic. She was feeling very, very pressured. Docs, DCJ at the time, were pretty much bottom lining saying, you need to leave that relationship, otherwise we are going to remove that baby because it's not safe. She was very upset about that, but it meant that we got her to a position where she was going to accept that she needed to leave. She did not want him to know because that was her plan, because she felt that he might harm her or harm the baby. Which, you know, why did I go along with that, Rose?
Well, so many reasons.
Why did I go along with that at the time? Okay, so what we did is we had a plan. We knew he would be out. I went with her and we were going to quickly pack up. So we were meant to be in and out of that house in a matter of 10 minutes.
Wow.
So I left all my stuff in the car, didn't have my phone, didn't have anything. Mobile phones were a thing then, but they were a new thing. Didn't have anything. All I had was my car keys. I had her, we had the baby. He then came home.
Of course he did.
Of course he did. He then came home and he was really angry. Really, really angry. And so we're now in a situation where I'm in this home. I'm holding the baby at this stage. They're starting to fight.
A bag's packed, like he's bags understanding packed. What's happening.
He knew exactly what was going on. He was so angry. He was screaming. He was shouting. He then deadbolted the door, locked the door, picked up a baseball bat, and then obviously turned on me because it was my fault that this was happening.
Of course it was.
Yeah. Was just shouting. Erratic behavior, shouting, pacing. You can imagine that.
Scratching his head, throwing his hands down.
Yeah. I was still holding the baby because I felt it was safer for me to hold the baby than for mum to hold the baby at that stage, because she was engaged in this verbal argument with him. It was on for young and old, to be fair. And so she then retreated. I gave the baby back to her because she came and grabbed the baby. Well, I mean, I couldn't hold that.
Her baby. Her baby. Power. Her statutory power to hold her baby.
By this stage, probably the door's been locked for probably a couple of minutes by this stage. So then I don't know how I did this, but I used all of, thank God, my training to slowly de-escalate everything. So started talking really slowly. Started talking really softly, started, you know, trying to calm him down, trying to calm her down, suggested we all sit down. Let's all sit down and let's kind of just take a breath. Let's sit down and let's try and sort this out. But then reminding him, you really need to unlock the door and you really need to put the bat down because we have to leave. So he would become inflamed whenever I said, you have to unlock the door because you have to unlock the door. He would become escalated again. So this went on, these type of conversations went on for about half an hour.
But you think about that, door lock is his power and yes. You're trying to use your power to get him to lessen his power.
Yeah.
So you're in this power struggle.
Yeah.
But you've been in his home for 18 months.
Yeah.
Doing all this other work before this where you've helped clean the house, you've been in meetings, you've advocated, they've kept their baby past birth.
So that's what I used in my favour.
Yeah.
I had to build on or pull on that capacity, that currency that I had to actually remind him that I was not the enemy, And he did not want to use that bat on me, like he did not want to. And then what he had to do was unlock the door. So I just had this very calm voice. I do not know how I had this very calm voice. I made them sit down. You know, suggested, I didn't make them, I pushed them down, but you know, suggested, let's all just take a seat. I did not sit down, but I moved away as far away as I could from him.
Yeah.
Without it being obvious that I was like, you know,
hedging your bets out to the
that's safe. True. So
where's the baby at this point?
Baby's still with mum,
mm-hmm.
Sitting down. And so I was kind of saying to him, okay, we just really need to get the door open. That was my message to him. Like in that voice, we really need to get the door open. We just have to open the door. It's actually not okay that you shut the door. We have to open the door. Let's just get the door open. Just let us out. and then we'll work this out. We'll work it all out, but we just need that door open. So I think it took 45 minutes for him to open the door, and that's all the message I kept repeating. I didn't do a lot of conversation. I tried to, and I saw that that actually just escalated him.
Yeah.
So I just kind of went back against the wall and just kept saying over and over and over, you really just need to open the door. We just really need that door open. I really need to open the door.
Oh, I'm thinking so many things. Like, imagine if your system had gone into fight mode or shut down.
I know.
Like, if you hadn't been able to keep yourself in that, you know, safe zone, that professionalism, using all your skills, if they had just plummeted and you end up freezing.
It was absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
But at the time, thank God my training kicked in. Thank God. Because I knew I had to get out of that house, or I was not going to get out of that house. Guy was crazy. He was very upset.
And crystal meth use, you know.
He was erratic. He was chaotic. He was everything. He unlocked the door and I asked if I could take the baby. And I knew that that was going to inflame the situation. And he started screaming. And then she started screaming, you're not taking my baby. You're not taking my baby. While they were screaming at me and preoccupied by their screaming, I walked to the door and got out. And then I said, that's okay. If you don't let me take your baby, that's fine. I'm not here to remove your baby. That's not my job. You know what my job is. And they were like, get out, and slammed the door. So I was out of the house, but the baby was still inside the house.
But I wonder if you then became the focal point for both of them, like a common goal, as opposed to him remembering she's trying to leave me and take my baby. You're now together. They've got this common.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah. Which, I don't know if that was conscious on your behalf, but pretty genius. Because she's still in that house with him.
Yeah. And I knew, but I also knew that the minute I said, listen, can we take the baby outside? I didn't say, let me take your baby. I said, can we all come outside? Can she come outside? No, she's not leaving the house. Can I take the baby then? And I'll just sit out here with the baby.
Yeah.
You can still see me. I'll just sit here. And then, I knew as soon as I mentioned the baby that they would both turn. So once I got outside, and I just kind of remember standing there thinking, holy shit, what just happened? This is insane. And then I think obviously all of your adrenaline response starts to happen. And I just knew that I just had to, I had to leave. They weren't going to let me have the baby. I was not going to put myself back into that house because my safety was something I should have thought more about.
Yeah.
At the beginning. So I kind of left and I had to do all the things that I had to do. That baby ended up being removed that day. And so then I did become the common enemy because of the confusion also around the power that I had in that professional relationship, and because we had some boundary issues where they saw me as a friend, they felt like I had absolutely betrayed them.
Mm. You'd been in their lives for 18 months already, and if you think about the context you gave for their social histories, it's probably a very long-term relationship for them.
Absolutely, it was. It was a long-term relationship. And those relationships, think about, what happens with someone who has an attachment dysregulation. There's push and there's pull all of the time. And so they were constantly testing me. And so I had pushed through a lot of the tests. Ugh. So it was a complete betrayal.
Yep.
Yeah. Which again, kind of for me, cemented the fact that, what was I doing? How did I let that get to that point? It wasn't just finding myself in that very unsafe situation that could have ended so badly for me and for her and for that baby and for him. But I also allowed this relationship to get to the point where no one was clear around what the purpose of the relationship was anymore.
It's interesting that you say, how did I let this get to this point? Because it's abdicating the agency you work for of their responsibility and their power in this, but also the other organizations that play in the other contexts, of agency in their life. you're taking all of that, how did I allow it to get this way?
It's
an true, agency it's allowed you to work in a home where there was parental drug use.
Yeah, yeah.
And a young baby, and you were working from a car pretty much autonomously, you know, with families that were, their presenting problem was drug use.
Yeah, it's true. How interesting that I still take responsibility. Yeah. You're right. That's a really interesting point to raise. But I continue to. I know.
I'm giving her a look.
I know she is giving me a look. I guess the thing about that example was then afterwards just got on with it. Just got back onto work. Like obviously had a bit of a meltdown. Like it was terrifying.
Of course you had a meltdown. Your body has to have a meltdown. Like that's, you know, that's the science of it. Your body has to, but then how do you, what happens? You have supervision with your manager or you go out for drinks or you just go home and cook dinner for your family and pack the day away? What did you do?
I remember driving around for a little bit, just trying to process what happened. And then I remember calling my manager and telling her what happened. And her offering to meet me, like, do you need me to meet you? And me saying, no, I'm okay.
And did she take that? Was she like, oh, okay. Or was she like, no, we are meeting?
No, she took it because I'd said it. Because I'd said it. And I remember going home and really trying to, the good thing about my practice, I don't know if you say my practice, but the good thing about having a family at that time for me was that it was really busy. I had young children. So I could actually, as much as possible, I could put work to work and I could just concentrate on home. But of course it didn't go away.
No.
Of course, if I could look back now, I would have just been a wreck.
Because last episode we talk about the backpack that we take to our clients. But you think about the backpack you take home too. If your family could look in your backpack that day and see what was in there, imagine what they would think.
Imagine. And I don't even remember now, but I probably would have just said, yeah, it was a bit of a hard day. That's probably how I would have talked about it.
Sure, that's how you would have talked about it. And I'm sitting here thinking about, well, three times where I've been locked in places by clients and felt very unsafe. And same thing. I remember almost a semi-siege in a home I was working with in the ACT, and there was a police officer in this unit with me, but we were in a high-rise.
Yeah.
Social housing on the very top floor, of course.
Yeah.
One exit,
yeah,
which was bolted locked, and the dad was standing in front of that door with a very large knife.
Yeah.
Not letting us out. And yeah. I think we're in the home for maybe 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
And I remember coming out, was winter, Canberra, cold
yeah.
as.
Yeah.
We come out, it was probably 6 o'clock at night by the time we got down.
Yeah.
And had to walk downstairs. There was, I think we were on, you know, maybe the 10th floor, carrying a baby, because that was the whole issue that had gone wrong again, trying to remove a baby, and walked downstairs to blue and red flashing lights, very cold, holding this baby. And my manager was there, and I remember thinking, oh, thank goodness. And she said to me, are you right to take the baby to the agency to place him into care? And I was like shaking with this baby thinking, you're not here to take the baby into Z Farm, all right? And of course I went, sure, no worries. I put the baby in her car seat, again alone, drove to the agency, the out-of-home care agency, handed the baby over, talked about what I knew about this baby.
Yeah.
Didn't have any belongings because I just wanted to get out of that house at the end.
Yeah.
And drove my hour and 45 minutes home and walked in the door. And I remember my husband saying, big day. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Went to bed, got up the next day, and went to work.
Exactly. That's exactly what I would have done. It's exactly what I would have done. Like, I bet if I asked my family now, was there a day where you think I was a bit weird? They would have no idea.
They would say no, because you probably had 5 weird days every month when you came home.
And I just a quick sideline, because you reminded me of this story. I remember once being in, again, what I say, but very unsafe department housing units. That was so unsafe that I had to, that the male person I was working with, that was working with a male and a female, and it was, again, this family support role, used to meet me at the front of the street and walk me up, because otherwise you wouldn't make it to their unit alive. There were dogs, there were people, yeah. There was knives, it was crazy. But anyway, this couple, so I had to rely on this man for my own safety to actually get to the unit. I should never have been in that unit. Anyway, and then there was this one particular day, I get into the unit, he's not there. So how did I get there? Anyway, I must have just walked myself up. I'm sure I would have been fucking
terrified.
So I get into the house, and so the docs manager and the DCJ manager and caseworker were visiting that day, which is the reason why I was there too, to kind of provide support around the visit to the, for the clients. And so they come, they do what they have to do, and then they leave. And thankfully, they did not walk into the unit. So they just kind of stayed at the door. Yeah.
Okay.
I stayed at the door. It was actually thankful because they left. Suddenly the front door closes and he's standing behind the front door with this huge knife. And he looks at me and he goes, you know what, Jody? I was waiting for her, the docs manager, the DCJ manager, to walk through. And I was about to stab her. That's why I'm here hiding. And I remember looking at him and going, well, you know, that means I can't come back here, don't you? And him saying, what do you mean? I'd never stab you. And I'm like,
just,
well, look, you know, I'm just going to go now. I just, you know, I can't come back though. So we're going to have to meet in the office from now on, all right? But do you mind just walking me back down? Because I
to
have
get
to
back get, out.
Because I have to get back to my car safely. Sure, no problem. Puts the knife down, walks me down. We have chit chat.
So I think
that's insane.
That is insane. And my mind is splitting into so many different like questions. But for him, the DCJ manager holds all that power.
Yes.
And for him, yeah. You're again in that friend.
In the friend zone.
I can tell you I was about to stab her.
Yeah.
All good. You're going to be cool with it. It's cool. You're allowed in. Never would I do that to you. Never, ever.
Never,
ever. But you're also there as a social worker.
Absolutely.
In a professional capacity.
Absolutely.
So that role confusion of power for our clients, which you said at the beginning, that's the best example of what does it look like for them?
Yeah. So it was so confusing for them because he told me this. So, of course, that baby was removed.
Of course.
That day. And the Navy Yard was slapped on him. Like, of course. I wasn't going to go.
And, of course, your professional relationship is severed. Is it?
It actually wasn't. It was crazy. This couple were so interesting. So we then started meeting in the office. Baby had already been removed. He says to me, I know it wasn't your fault the baby was removed, Jody. You had to do it. I mean, I guess I shouldn't have told you.
So maybe he did know about your power.
Maybe he did. I don't know. He was a man who had been involved with child protection and criminal justice system for most of his life.
Okay.
He was very institutionalized. So, But it's insane, isn't it?
It is insane.
It's insane. Yeah.
And you think about, and you're probably, you know, sitting there listening, thinking about all those familiar stories you have for yourselves too, because you let the guard down and tell one and then the rest start coming of all those very scary situations.
Yeah.
That have occurred, you know, in your career.
Absolutely. Do you know that example, though, that example of being in that house, whilst it wasn't the only example I've had of feeling unsafe, and I think it was the response from the parents after the baby was removed, the way that they just had this, they blamed me for it and how I took responsibility for it a little bit as well.
Yeah, and I think you still kind of
are. I still kind of are.
20 plus years later.
Absolutely, because that whole situation should have been avoided. Anyway, let's not get onto that. But that case is still with me and it still sticks with me. And certainly I left that role. I went to child protection, you know, casework managing and child protection. And I remember around 2012-ish when there was yet another child protection reform, and Practice First was the reform that was coming in. And basically what that was saying, you remember this, Rose, basically what that was saying was that child protection work would be very much strength focused.
Yep.
I think to the detriment of actually doing a proper assessment of child safety and risk. And that child protection workers would really become like family support workers. And as managers, Rose will know this because we were in these same meetings. We had to go sit in these propaganda meetings where we had to watch these videos of these, oh my God, these like, you know, workers and clients, you know, gardening together and kind of talking about how amazing it was that this new way of work has really made such a big difference and blah, blah. And I just had this immense response to that because for me, that took me back to role confusion, confusion about power. What is that actually going to mean for the children? What is that going to mean for the workers? How could I keep my workers safe? How could I keep them safe when no one was really clear around what it is we were supposed to be doing, whereas it had been very clear?
And like I think about that time, I was pregnant at the time, and I remember thinking, and this is terrible, but thank goodness I'm going on maternity leave because I wasn't sure and I hadn't had that experience. But I remember a video where a statutory child protection worker was doing the dishes in a client's home.
I remember, with the gloves.
Yes. And I remember thinking, you know, I'd worked with homeless young people in the ACT and, you know, remembered painting walls to get them out of, you know, massive debts, moving out of their homes.
Yeah.
I remember doing gardening and cleaning up because that's what you did. It was kind of a family support role, but for young people at the time. And the whole point was to get them off the streets and into secure homes. And so I had with this client. And then here we are packing everything again because she'd been evicted. And I remember watching that video of this worker cleaning the dishes and thinking, thank goodness I am pregnant. And thank goodness I'm going on that leave because I don't know how this plays out and I'm not sure I wanted to be the first kind of guinea pig. But I also remember I came back from my mat leave and you had gone.
Yeah, I had to because I could not do it. This response I've had, this internal response I had was I just can't do that. I can't do it. I can't be in a situation where I am not sure what it is I'm supposed to be doing. And, you know, I just could not send my workers out to a situation where they weren't sure what they would be doing because I knew it would put them unsafe.
Yeah.
It would mean they were unsafe. And it would mean that terrible work was being done. And I just couldn't, because it had to, because if you're focusing solely on strengths and at all costs trying to remove children, and I'm not saying children should be removed willy-nilly. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that we have to, as much work as we put into strengths, we should put the same amount of work into actually considering challenges and how to work on the challenges.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying.
And I guess whether it was failed marketing, because, you know, obviously there was the razzle-dazzle of the videos and we had very shiny brochures, I remember, at that time about practice first. So whether it was a failing on the marketing side or that was, you know, how it was to be advertised to us as a staff, the message was very clear.
Yeah.
You would be side by side with the parents, helping them address very basic needs like dishes, gardening, cleaning a house. Like that was the sole child protection problem of the day.
Which is, we're certainly not suggesting that a family support role shouldn't do that stuff because it should. It should.
Absolutely.
But a child protection role can do that stuff as well, but it can't be the focus and it can't be the statutory agency's focus of practice.
Yes.
That's the issue because it's a statutory agency. There's an important role that a statutory agency has in any community and it's about keeping children safe. And sometimes keeping children safe is to actually do that side-by-side work. Absolutely. But after a really good assessment's been done and you know that there's a goal and you know that this will actually achieve safety.
And the family can articulate the challenges and the child protection risk issues that they are addressing too.
Yeah.
It's very transparent. There's nothing opaque about the work.
No.
We're not coming here just to do the dishes and, you know, make a child's bed.
Or to just, you know, just do like checkbook casework where you're just giving money constantly. I mean, also to give a bit of context, DCJ, DOCS at the time, Department of Communities and Services, so the statutory agency of New South Wales, had already trialled a family support type program. Brighter Futures is still around now and it's a family support program for children and for families where there are child protection risk concerns. But when it first came out, there was like, it was like a 50-50 split, wasn't it? DCG had some and non-govs had some in terms of caseloads. And there's a reason why they took it, why there was a review done, and the review recommended taking that out of a statutory agency because statutory workers cannot do family support.
And, you know, the whole purpose of this episode is about power. And if you think about that system's power, how do you go in with all that statutory power and all the legislation as a brighter futures worker?
It's impossible. It's impossible.
You can't hold two roles. You can't have the statutory power, the legislative power to remove a child, but be there as a brighter futures worker who, if it gets so bad, a whoop can remove your child. But I'm here as your brighter futures worker.
You can't have it both ways. It doesn't work that way.
No.
You can never get rid of the statutory power attached to the role. You just can't. And families are smarter. Families know that you want to be on side with them. You want to be their worker. And so they know that they can just ask for stuff. And because, I'm going to say this and get myself into trouble, and this is a generalized statement, but in my experience at that time, we're talking 2010-ish, when Brighter Futures would have come out.
Yeah.
At that time, you know, there wasn't a lot of focus on how to build rapport. So families worked out very quickly, the ones that were involved with the Department of Community Services, Brighter Futures teams, that the way that rapport was being built was by asking for stuff, and money was just given out.
Mm.
Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
The amount of clients that would move from that program to child protection, and then we would have to become involved with them, and they would say, they were giving me hundreds of dollars a week. They paid for this, they paid for that, they did everything.
Yeah. And then I guess what's the outcome of that? Further dependency on a system and a very opaque power imbalance.
Well, and it disempowered the family.
Completely disempowered. Because where did most of those families probably end up? In that statutory child protection system.
And suddenly they're trying to work out, well, how come if I was still working with dogs, how come you work so differently than these people?
Mm.
Why aren't you giving me hundreds of dollars each week? Why are you saying that my children are at risk when they weren't at risk a week ago when I worked with this person?
And nothing's really changed.
And nothing's really changed.
So interesting. So I just want to go back to, you're sitting in 2012 and the new Practice First comes out, and your decision was, I'm out of this system.
Yeah, had to. I had to for my own sanity. I just remember thinking, I cannot do that again. Cannot do that again.
When you decided, I'll share this practice example today.
Yeah.
What is it you wanted us to really take from it?
I guess the reason why, because I did think a lot about what practice example I would share, and I guess the reason why I chose this one is because for me it just illustrates that link between power and role and what happens to practice when you're confused about
role clarity. Okay. And so I think you definitely illustrated that and made that point. But what I really like about that is in 2025, you're a private practitioner social worker and you do a lot of assessments in the child protection space.
Yeah.
And I think you are using your power now in a very different way to challenge the system.
Yeah.
And working one-on-one with clients and centering clients in that one-on-one work, but you are still such an advocate for system change and for the system bullshit. So when you're seeing the system impacting on the families you're working with, you're advocating, you're calling it out, you're raising awareness to that. So you didn't just walk away and go, I can't do this. You know, I've been here before, I've had this reaction and I'm out. You've went and did other roles and have come back as a private practitioner to use your power in a very different way to still advocate for change in that system.
Well, that's true. But I think you did that too. I think we both did it. I think that's why we find ourselves here.
When if you're out there listening and you're in maybe the same situation where you're having a very real reaction to something that's happening in the space you're working in, it doesn't mean that you're closing a door necessarily to the advocacy or the, you know, any practice you want to work as. It's just you may need to come at it in a different way,
yep,
or in a different organization. You may need a bit of time,
yep,
in a different role, and then, you know, you can come back and do something else. It's not necessarily an ending when you walk away from a job. And if you are familiar with Dr. Vicki Reynolds' work, she calls it spiritual pain. If you're feeling that spiritual pain and it's wrapped up in the power of your social work practice or the power of your organization, sometimes the best thing to do is to close the chapter and find a new way to do the work you want to do.
Yeah.
And to advocate for really solid social work practice in a different form.
It's also, yeah, I agree completely with what you said, but I also think it's sometimes about, even if you decide to stay in the agency you're in or you decide to move on, it is about picking battles, isn't it? And it's about, yes, understanding what it is that you can affect change about and not wasting energy trying to fight a battle that you're never going to actually win.
Yes. So it comes back to your circle of control,
yeah,
and your circle of influence.
Yeah. And being really clear about that.
Yes.
And I think being really clear about your power within that control and influence.
Absolutely. Which is why I think I always struggled with anti-oppressive theory, because as an individual, one-on-one, yep, I have always struggled to say, how do I demonstrate I'm working in an anti-oppressive, yep, manner when the systems feel so big and so large and I know I can't change all the systems?
Yep.
So it is about absolutely understanding your power,
yep,
in your circle of control and, yep, your circle of influence.
Yeah. And I think anti-oppressive practice is about questioning. It's about being curious and it's about advocating. Yeah. But, yep, surely it's not about putting yourself at risk emotionally, physically, spiritually.
Absolutely. I agree. It's none of that.
Yeah.
Those things happen, but, yep,
it's not the focus.
It's not the focus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my, wow, goodness. That was a big chat.
It was. I think kind of took me by surprise how much and how long we've talked about power. Good, yeah, practice examples though, Jodi. I felt like I was in that house with you.
Yeah.
Could see the dad with the bat.
Yeah.
Could see the baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really good practice.
It happened so long ago, but it still has such a interesting place in my mind.
Interesting in itself, interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. All right. I think we're just going to wrap up. We're finished.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in. Please hit subscribe so that other social workers can find us. Rate and review us.
Tell your friends.
Tell your friends.
Tell your colleagues. And please tune in next fortnight for a discussion about attachment. Until then, stay safe and continue to practice relationally.